I'd really like to go off somewhere with him and have a coke. I suppose that would be all right, as long as you don't keep him too long. This is a school night. Sure, that's very nice of you. There was a tap at the door. Mr. Westfall rose and crossed the room. This will be Tony, he said. The door slid back, and Tony Gahan came in. He looked like an immature 15. He was maybe 5'6", 125 pounds. His uncle introduced me. I proffered my hand, and we fumbled through a handshake. Tony's eyes were dark, his hair a medium brown, attractively cut, which struck me as odd. Most of the high school kids I've seen lately look like they are being treated for the same scalp disease. I suspected Tony's hairstyle was a concession to Farron Westfall's notions of good taste, and I wondered how that sat with him. His manner was anxious. He seemed like a kid trying desperately to please. He shot a cautious look at his uncle, searching for visual clues as to what was expected of him and how he was meant to behave. It was painful to watch. "Miss Milhone would like to take you out for a coke so she can talk to you," Mr. Westfall said.
End of Disc 3. Disc 4.
"Miss Milhone would like to take you out for a coke so she can talk to you," Mr. Westfall said. "How come?" he croaked. Tony looked like he was going to drop dead on the spot, and I remembered in a flash how much I'd hated eating and drinking in the presence of strange adults when I was his age. Meals represent a series of traps when you haven't yet mastered the appropriate social skills. I hated adding to his distress, but I was convinced I'd never have a decent conversation with him in this house. "She'll explain all that," Mr. Westfall said. "Obviously, you're not required to go. If you'd prefer to stay here, simply say so." Tony seemed unable to get a reading from his uncle's statement, which was neutral on the surface, but contained some tricky side notes. It was the word simply that tripped him, I thought, and the obviously didn't help. Tony glanced at me with a half shrug. "It's okay, I guess. Like right now?" Mr. Westfall nodded. "It won't be for long. You'll need a jacket, of course." Tony moved out into the hall, and I followed, waiting until he found his jacket in the hall closet. At 15, I thought he could probably figure out if he needed a jacket or not, but neither of them consulted me on the subject. I opened the front door and held it while he went out. Mr. Westfall watched us for a moment and then closed the door behind us. God, it was just like a date. I nearly swore I'd have him home by 10 o'clock. Absurd. We made our way down the path in the dark. "You go to Santa Teresa High School?"
"Right."
"What year?"
"Sophomore."
We got in the car. Tony tried to roll down the smashed window on his side without much success. A shard of glass tinkled down into the door frame. He finally gave up.
"What happened to this?"
"I was careless," I said, and let it go at that. I did a U-turn in the lane, and I headed for the Clockworks on State Street, a teen hangout generally regarded as seedy, unclean, and corrupt, which it is, a training ground for junior thugs. Kids come here, stoned, no doubt, to drink cokes, smoke clove cigarettes, and behave like badasses. I'd been introduced to the place by a 17-year-old pink-haired dope dealer named Mike, who made more money than I did. I hadn't seen him since June, but I tend to look for him around town. We parked in a small lot out back and went in through the rear entrance. The place is long and narrow, painted charcoal gray, the high ceiling rimmed with pink and purple neon. A series of mobiles, looking like big black clock gears, revolve in the smoky air. The noise level on weekends is deafening, the music so loud it makes the floor vibrate. On weeknights, it's quiet and oddly intimate. We found a table, and I went over to the counter to pick up a couple of cokes. There was a tap on my shoulder, and I turned to find Mike standing there. I felt a rush of warmth.
"I was just thinking about you," I said. "How are you?"
A pink tint crept across his cheeks, and he gave me a slow, seductive smile.
"I'm okay. What are you doing these days?"
"Nothing much," I said. "Great hair." Formerly, he'd sported a mohawk, a great coxcomb of pink down the center of his head with the side shaved close. Now it was arranged in a series of purple spurts, each clump held together with a rubber band, the feathery tips bleached white.
Aside from the hair, he was a good-looking kid. Clear skin, green eyes, good teeth. I said, "Actually, I'm about to have a talk with that guy over there, a schoolmate of yours." "Yeah?" He turned and gave Tony a cursory inspection. "You know him?" "I've seen him. He doesn't hang out with the kind of people I do." His gaze returned to Tony, and I thought he was going to say more, but he let it pass. "What are you up to?" I asked. "Still dealing?" "Who, me? Hey, no. I told you I'd quit," he said, sounding faintly righteous. The look in his eyes, of course, suggested just the opposite. If he was doing something illegal, I didn't want to know about it anyway, so I bypassed the subject. "What about school? You graduate this year?" "June. I got college applications out and everything." "Really?" I couldn't tell if he was putting me on or not. He caught the look. "I get good grades," he protested. "I'm not just your average high school dunce, you know. The bucks I got, I could go any place I want. That's what private enterprise is about." I had to laugh. "For sure," I said. The barmaid set two cokes on the counter, and I paid her. "I have to get back to my date." "Nice seeing you," he said. "You ought to come in sometime and talk to me." "Maybe I'll do that," I said. I smiled at him, mentally shaking my head. Flirtatious little shit. I moved over to the table where Tony was sitting. I handed him a Coke and sat down. "You know that guy?" Tony asked cautiously. "Who, Mike?" "Yes, I know him." Tony's eyes strayed to Mike and back again, resting on my face with something close to respect. Maybe I wasn't such a geek after all. "Did your uncle tell you what this is about?" I asked. "Some. He said the accident and that old drunk." "You feel okay discussing it?" He shrugged by way of reply, avoiding eye contact. "I take it you weren't in the car," I said. He smoothed the front of his hair to the side. Me and my mom got into this argument. They were going to my granny's for this Easter egg hunt, and I didn't want to go." "Your grandmother's still in town someplace?" He shifted in his chair. "In a rest home. She had a stroke." "She's your mother's mother." I didn't care particularly about any of this. I was just hoping the kid would relax and open up.
"Yeah."
"What's it like living with your aunt and uncle?"
"Fine, no big deal. He comes down on my case all the time, but she's nice."
"She said you were having some problems at school."
"So?"
"Just curious. She says you're very smart and your grades are in the toilet. I wondered what that was about."
"It's about school sucks," he said. "It's about I don't like people butting into my fucking business."
"Really?" I said. I took a sip of Coke. His hostility was like a sewer backing up, and I thought I'd give the efflux a chance to subside. I didn't care if he cussed. I could out-cuss him any day of the week. When I didn't react, he filled the silence.
"I'm trying to get my grades pulled up," he said somewhat grudgingly. "I had to take all this bullshit math and chemistry. That's why I didn't do good."
"What's your preference? English? Art?" He hesitated.
"You some kind of shrink?"
"No, I'm a private investigator. I assumed you knew that." He stared at me.
"I don't get it. What's this got to do with the accident?"
I took out the check and laid it on the table. "The man responsible wanted me to look you up and give you this." He picked the check up and glanced at it. "It's a cashier's check for $25,000, I said.
"What for?"
"I'm not really sure. I think John Daggett was hoping to make restitution for what he did." Tony's confusion was clear, and so was the anger that accompanied it.
"I don't want this," he said. "Why give it to me? Megan Smith died too, you know, and so did that other guy, Doug. Are they getting money too, or just me?"
"Just you, as far as I know."
"Take it back, then. I don't want it. I hate that old bastard."
He tossed the check on the table and gave it a push. "Look, now just wait and let me say something first. It's your choice, honestly, it's up to you. Your aunt was offended by the offer, and I understand that. No one can force you to accept the money if you don't want it. But just hear me out, okay?" Tony was staring off across the room, his face set. I lowered my voice. "Tony, it's true John Daggett was a drunk, and maybe he was a totally worthless human being. But he did something he felt bad about, and I think he was trying to make up for it. Give him credit for that much, and don't say no without giving it consideration first.
I don't want money for what he did.
I'm not done yet. Just let me finish this.
His mouth trembled. He made a dash at his eyes with the sleeve of his jacket, but he didn't get up and walk away.
People make mistakes, I said. People do things they never meant to do. He didn't kill anyone deliberately.
He's a fucking drunk. He was out on the fucking street at fucking 9 in the morning. Dad and Mom and Hillary...
His voice broke, and he fought for control.
I don't want anything from him. I hate his guts, and I don't want his crummy check.
Why don't you cash it and give it all away?
No, you take it. Give it back to him. Tell him I said he could get fucked.
I can't. He's dead. He was killed Friday night.
Good, I'm glad. I hope somebody cut his heart out. He deserved it.
Maybe so, but it's still possible that he felt something for you and wanted to give you back some of what he took away.
Like what? It's done. They're all dead.
But you're not, Tony. You have to find a way to get on with life.
Hey, I'm doing that, okay? But I don't have to listen to this bullshit. You said what you had to say, and now I want to go home.
He got up, radiating rage, his whole body stiff. He moved swiftly toward the rear entrance, knocking chairs aside. I snatched up the check and followed. When I reached the parking lot, he was kickboxing the remaining glass out of the smashed window of my car. I started to protest, and then I stopped myself.
Oh, why not, I thought. I had to replace the damn thing anyway.
I stood and watched him without a word. When he was done, he leaned against the car and wept. Chapter 15. By the time I got Tony home again, he was calm, shut down, as if nothing out of the ordinary had occurred. I pulled up in front of the house. He got out, slammed the door, and headed up the path without a word. I was reasonably certain he wouldn't mention his outburst to his aunt and uncle, which was fortunate, as I'd sworn I could talk to him without his getting upset. I was, of course, still in possession of Daggett's check, wondering if I'd be toting it around for life, trying in vain to get someone to take it off my hands. When I got back to my place, I spent 20 minutes unloading my VW. While I tend to maintain an admirable level of tidiness in the apartment, my organizational skills have never extended to my car. The back seat is usually crowded with files, law books, my briefcase, piles of miscellaneous clothing, shoes, pantyhose, jackets, hats, some of which I use as disguises in the various aspects of my trade. I packed everything in a cardboard box, and then proceeded around to the backyard where the entrance to my apartment is located. I opened the padlock on the storage bin attached to the service porch and stowed the box, snapping the padlock into place again. As I reached my door, a dark shape loomed out of the shadows.
Kinsey?
I jumped, realizing belatedly that it was Billy Polo. I couldn't distinguish his features in the dark, but his voice was distinctly his own.
Oh, Jesus, what are you doing here? I said.
Hey, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you. I wanted to talk to you.
I was still trying to recover from the jolt he'd given me, my temper rising belatedly.
How'd you know where to find me?
I looked you up in the telephone book.
My home address isn't in the book.
Yeah, I know. I tried your office first. You weren't in, so I asked next door at that insurance place.
California Fidelity gave you my home address, I said.
Who'd you talk to?
I didn't believe for a minute that CF would release that kind of information to him.
I didn't get her name. I told her I was a client and it was urgent.
Bullshit.
No, it's the truth. She only gave it to me because I leaned on her.
I could tell he wasn't going to budge on the point, so I let it pass.
All right, what is it? I said.
I knew I sounded cranky, but I didn't like his coming to my place, and I didn't believe his tale about how he found out where it was.
We're just going to stand around out here?
That's right, Billy. Now get on with it.
Well, you don't have to get so huffy.
Huffy? What the hell are you talking about? You loom up out of the dark and scare me half to death? I don't know you from Jack the Ripper, so why should I invite you in?
Okay, okay.
Just say what you have to say. I'm beat.
He did some fidgeting around, for effect, I thought. Finally, he said,
I talked to my sister Coral, and she told me I should be straight with you.
Oh, goody, what a treat. Straight about what?
Daggett, he mumbled. He did get in touch.
When was this?
Last Monday, when he got to town.
He called you?
Yeah, that's right.
How'd he know where you were? He tried my mom's house and talked to her. I wasn't home at the time, so she got his number and I called him back.
Where'd he call from?
I don't know for sure. Some dive. There was all this noise in the background. He was drunk and I figured he must have parked himself in the first bar he found.
What time of day was this?
Maybe 8 at night. Around in there.
Go on.
He said he was scared and needed help. Somebody called him down in Los Angeles and told him he was dead meat on account of a scam he pulled up in prison just before he got out.
What scam?
I don't know all the details. What I heard was his cellmate got snuffed and Daggett helped himself to a big wad of cash the guy had hidden in his bunk.
How much?
Nearly 30 grand. It was some kind of drug deal went sour, which was why the guy got killed in the first place. Daggett walked off with the whole stash and somebody wanted it back. They were coming after him. At least that's what they told him.
Who?
I don't want to mention names. I got a fair idea, and I could find out for sure if I wanted to, but I don't like putting my neck in a noose unless I have to. The point is, I shined him on. I wasn't going to help that old coot. No way. He got himself in a hole. Let him get himself out. I didn't want to be involved. Not with those guys after him. I'm too fond of my health.
So what happened? You talked on the phone and that was it?
Well, no, I met him for a drink. Coral said I should level with you about that.
Really? I said. What for?
In case something came up later. She didn't want it to look like I was holding out.
So you think they caught up with him?
He's dead, ain't he?
Proving what?
Don't ask me. I mean, all I know is what Daggett said. He was on the run and he thought I'd help.
How?
A place to hide.
When did you meet with him?
Not till Thursday. I was tied up.
Pressing social engagements, no doubt.
Hey, I was looking for work. I'm on parole and I got requirements to meet.
You didn't see him Friday?
Uh-uh. I just saw him once and that was Thursday night.
What did he do in the meantime?
I don't know. He never said.
Where'd you meet him?
At the bar where Coral works.
Ah, now I see. She got worried I'd ask around and somebody'd say they saw you with him.
Well, yeah. Coral don't like me to mess with the law, especially with me on parole anyway.
How come it took the bad guys so long to catch up with him? He's been out of prison for 6 weeks.
Maybe they didn't figure it was him at first. Daggett wasn't the brightest guy, you know. He never did nothing right in his life. They probably figured he was too dumb to stick his hand in a mattress and walk off with the cash.
Did Daggett have the money with him when you talked to him?
Are you kidding? He tried to borrow 10 bucks from me, Billy said, aggrieved.
What was the deal? I asked. If he gave the money back, they'd let him off the hook?
Probably not. I doubt that.
So do I said. How do you think Lavella figures into this?
She doesn't. It's got nothing to do with her.
I wouldn't be too sure about that. Somebody saw Daggett down at the marina last Friday night, dead drunk, in the company of a trashy-looking blonde. Even in the dark, I could tell Billy Polo was staring at me.
A blonde?
That's right. She was on the young side, from what I was told. He was staggering, and she had to work to keep him on his feet.
I don't know nothing about that.
Neither do I, but it sure sounded like Lavella to me.
Ask her about it, then.
I intend to, I said. So what happens next?
About what?
The 30,000, for starters. With Daggett dead, does the money go back to the guys who were after him?
If they found it, I guess it does, he said uncomfortably.
What if they didn't find it? Billy hesitated.
Well, I guess if it's stashed somewhere, it'd belong to his widow, wouldn't it? Part of his estate?
I was beginning to get the drift here, but I wondered if he did.
You mean Essie?
Who?
Daggett's widow, Essie.
He's divorced from her, Billy said.
I don't think so. At least not as far as the law is concerned.
He's married to Lavella, he said.
Not legally.
You're shitting me.
Come to the funeral tomorrow and see for yourself.
This Essie has the money?
No, but I know where it is. 25,000 of it, at any rate.
Where?
He said with disbelief. In my pocket, sweetheart, in the form of a cashier's check made out to Tony Gahan. You remember Tony, don't you? Dead silence. I lowered my voice. You want to tell me who Doug Polakowski is? Billy Polo turned and walked away.
I stood there for a moment and then followed reluctantly, still pondering the fact that he had my home address. Last time I'd talked to him, he didn't even buy the fact that I was a private investigator. Now suddenly he was seeking me out, having confidential chats about Daggett on my front step. It didn't add up. I heard his car door slam as I reached the street. I hung back in the shadows, watching as he swung the Chevrolet out of a parking place four doors down. He gunned it, speeding off toward the beach. I debated about whether to pursue him, but I couldn't bear the thought of lurking about outside Coral's trailer again. Enough of that stuff. I turned back and let myself into my apartment. I kept thinking about the fact that my car was broken into, my handbag stolen, along with all of my personal identification. Had Billy Polo done that? Is that how he came up with my home address? I couldn't figure out how he'd tracked me to the beach in the first place, but it would explain how he knew where to find me now. I was sure he was maneuvering, but I couldn't figure out what he'd hoped to get. Why the yarn about Daggett and the bad guys in jail? It did fit with some of the facts, but it didn't have that nice, untidy ring of truth. I hauled out a stack of index cards and wrote it all down anyway. Maybe it would make sense later when other information came to light. It was 10 o'clock by the time I finished. I pulled the white wine out of the refrigerator, wiggled the cork loose, and poured myself a glass. I stripped my clothes off, turned the lights out, and toted the wine into the bathroom, where I set it on the windowsill in the bathtub, and stared out at the darkened street. There's a street light out there, buried in the branches of a jacaranda tree, largely denuded now by the rain. The window was half opened, and a damp slat of night wind wafted in, chilly and secretive. I could hear rain begin to rattle on my composition roof. I was restless. When I was a young girl, maybe 12 or so, I wandered the streets on nights like this, barefoot in a raincoat, feeling anxious and strange. I don't think my aunt knew about my nocturnal excursions, but maybe she did. She had a restless streak of her own, and she may have honored mine. I was thinking a lot about her of late, perhaps because of Tony. His family had been wiped out in a car accident, just as mine had, and he was being raised now by an aunt. Sometimes I had to admit to myself, especially on nights like this, that the death of my parents may not have been as tragic as it seemed. My aunt, for all her failings, was a perfect guardian for me. Brazen, remote, eccentric, independent. Had my parents lived, my life would have taken an altogether different route. There was no doubt of that in my mind. I like my history just as it is, but there was something else going on as well. Looking back on the evening, I realized how much I'd identified with Tony's kicking my car window out. The rage and defiance were hypnotic and touched off deep feelings of my own. Daggett's funeral was coming up the next afternoon, and that touched off something else. Old sorrows, good friends gone down into the earth. Sometimes I pictured death as a wide stone staircase filled with a silent procession of those being led away. I see death too often to worry about it much, but I missed the departed, and I wonder if I'll be docile when my turn comes. I finished my wine and went to bed, sliding naked into the warm folds of my quilt. Chapter 16. The dawn was accompanied by drizzle, dark gray sky gradually shading to a cold white light. Ordinarily, I don't run in the rain, but I hadn't slept well, and I needed to clear away the dregs of nagging anxiety. I wasn't even sure what I was worried about. Sometimes I awaken uncomfortably aware of a low-level dread humming in my gut. Running is the only relief I can find short of drink and drugs, which at 6 a.m. don't appeal. I pulled on a sweatsuit and hit the bike path, jogging a mile and a half to the recreation center. The palm trees along the boulevard had shed dried fronds in the wind, and they lay on the grass like soggy feathers. The ocean was silver, the surf rustling mildly like a taffeta skirt with a ruffle of white. The beach was a drab brown, populated by seagulls snatching at sand fleas. Pigeons lifted in a cloud, looking on. I have to admit I'm not an outdoor person at heart. I'm always aware that under the sprightly twitter of birds, bones are being crunched and ribbons of flesh are being stripped away, all of it the work of bright-eyed creatures without feeling or conscience. I don't look to nature for comfort or serenity. Traffic was light. There were no other joggers. I passed the public restrooms, housed in a cinder-block building painted flesh pink, where two bums huddled with a shopping cart. One I recognized from two nights before, and he watched me now, indifferently. His friend was curled up under a cardboard comforter, looking like a pile of old rags. I reached the turnaround and ran the mile and a half back. By the time I got home, my Etonics were soaked, my sweatpants were darkened by the drizzle, and the mist had beaded in my hair like a net of seed pearls. I took a long hot shower, optimism returning now that I was safely home again. After breakfast, I tidied up and then checked my automobile insurance policy and determined that the replacement of my car window was covered, after a $50 deductible. At 8:30, I started soliciting estimates from auto glass shops, trying to persuade someone to work me in before noon that day. I zipped myself into my all-purpose dress again, resurrected a decent-looking black leather shoulder bag that I use for formal wear, and filled it with essentials, including the accursed cashier's check. I dropped the car off at an auto glass shop not far from my office and hoofed it the rest of the way to work. Even with low-heeled pumps, my feet hurt, and my pantyhose made me feel like I was walking around with a hot, moist hand in my crotch. I let myself into the office and initiated my usual morning routine. The phone rang as I was plugging in the coffee pot.
"Miss Milhone, this is Ramona Westfall."
"Oh, hello," I said. "How are you?" Secretly, my stomach did a little twist, and I wondered if Tony Gayen had told her about his freakout at the clockworks the night before.
"I'm fine," she said. "I'm calling because there's something I'd like to discuss with you, and I hoped you might have some time free this morning."
"Well, my schedule's clear, but I don't have a car. Can you come down here?"
"Yes, of course. I'd prefer that anyway. Is 10 convenient? It's short notice, I know."
I glanced at my watch. 20 minutes. "That's fine," I said. She made some goodbye noises and clicked off. I depressed the line and then put a call through to Barbara Daggett at her mother's house to verify the time of the funeral. She was unavailable to come to the phone, but Eugene Nickerson told me the services were at 2 o'clock, and I said I'd be there. I took a few minutes to open my mail from the day before, posting a couple of checks to accounts receivable, then made a quick call to my insurance agent, giving her the sketchy details about my car window. I'd no more than put the phone down when it rang again.
"Kinsey, this is Barbara Daggett. Something's come up. When I arrived here this morning, there was some woman sitting on the porch steps who says she's Daddy's wife."
"Oh, God, Lovella.
You know about her?"
"I met her last week when I was down in L.A. trying to get a line on your father's whereabouts."
"And you knew about this claim of hers?"
"I never heard the details, but I gathered they were living in some kind of common-law relationship."
"Kinsey, she has a marriage certificate. I saw it myself. Why didn't you tell me what was going on? I was speechless. She stood out on the front porch, screaming bloody murder until I finally had to call the police. I can't believe you didn't at least mention it."
"When was I supposed to do that? At the morgue? Over at the funeral home with your mother in a state of collapse?"
"You could have called me, Kinsey. Any time. You could have come to my office to discuss it."
"Barbara, I could have done half a dozen things, but I didn't. Frankly, I was feeling protective of your father, and I was hoping you wouldn't have to find out about this alleged marriage. That certificate could be a fake. The whole thing could be trumped up, and if not, you've still got problems enough without adding bigamy to his list of personal failings."
"That isn't yours to decide. Now Mother wants to know what the ruckus was about, and I have no idea what to say."
"Well, I can see why you're upset, but I'm not sure I'd do it any differently."
"I can't believe you take that attitude. I don't appreciate being kept in the dark," she said. "I hired you to investigate, and I expect you to pass on whatever comes to light."
"Your father hired me long before you did," I said. That silenced her for a moment, and then she took off again.
"To do what? You never did specify."
"Of course I didn't. He talked to me confidentially. It was all bullshit, but it's still not mine to flap around. I couldn't stay in business if I blabbed all the information that came my way."
"I'm his daughter. I have a right to know, especially if my father's a bigamist. What else am I paying you for?"
"You might be paying me to exercise a little judgment of my own," I said. "Come on, Barbara, be reasonable. Suppose I'd told you. What purpose would that have served? If your parents are still legally married, Lovella has no claim whatever, and for all I know, she's perfectly aware of that." "Why add to your grief when she might well have slunk away without a word?"
"How did she know he died in the first place?" Not from me, I can tell you that. I'm not an idiot. The last thing in the world I wanted was her up here camping out on your doorstep. Maybe she read it in the paper. Maybe she heard it on the news.
She murmured something, temporarily mollified.
What happened when the cops got there? I asked. There was another pause while she debated whether to move on or continue berating me. I sensed that she enjoyed chewing people out, and it was hard for her to give up the opportunity. From my point of view, she wasn't paying me enough to take much guff. A little bit, perhaps. I probably should have told her.
The two officers took her aside and had a talk with her. She left a few minutes ago.
Well, if she shows up again, I'll take care of it, I said.
Again? Why would she do that?
I remembered then that aside from the matter of her father's apparent bigamy, I hadn't told her about the infamous $25,000, which Billy Polo assumed was part of Daggett's estate. Maybe Lavella had come up here to collect.
I think we better have a chat soon, I said.
Why? Is there something else?
I looked up. Ramona Westfall was standing in my doorway.
There's always something else, I said. That's what makes life so much fun. I've got someone here. I'll talk to you this afternoon.
I hung up and rose to my feet, shaking hands with Mrs. Westfall across the desk. I invited her to take a seat and then poured coffee for us both, using social ritual as a way of setting her at ease. Or so I hoped. She was looking drawn, the fine skin under her mild eyes smudged with fatigue. She wore a tan poplin shirtwaist with shoulder epaulettes and carried a mesh and canvas bag that looked like it could be packed for a quick safari somewhere. Her pale hair had the sheen of a Breck shampoo ad in a magazine. I tried to picture her in a raincoat, lurching around the marina with Daggett's arm draped over her shoulder. Could she have flipped him, ass over tea kettle, right out of that skiff?
Hey, sure, why not?
She stared at me uneasily, reaching out automatically to straighten some items on my desk. She lined up three pencils with the points facing me, like little ground-to-air missiles, and then she cleared her throat.
Well, we were wondering. Tony never said anything, so we thought perhaps we should ask you about it. Did you tell Tony about the money when you talked to him last night?
Sure, I said. Not that it did any good. I got nowhere. He was adamant. He wouldn't even discuss it.
She colored slightly.
We're thinking to take it, she said. Farron and I talked about it last night while Tony was out with you, and we're beginning to believe we should put the money in a trustee account for him, at least until he's 18 and really has a sense of what he might do with it.
What brought about the change?
Oh, everything, I guess. We've been in family counseling, and the therapist keeps hoping we can work through some of the anger and the grief. He feels Tony's migraines are stress-related in part, a sort of index of his unwillingness. Or maybe inability is a better word, to process his loss. I've been wondering how much I've contributed to that. I haven't dealt with Abby's death that well, and it can't have helped him.
She paused and then shook her head slightly as though embarrassed.
I know it's a reversal. I suppose we've been unnecessarily rude to you, and I'm sorry.
You don't have to apologize, I said. Personally, I'd be delighted to have you take the check. At least then I could feel I'd discharged my responsibilities. If you change your mind later, you can always donate the money to a worthy cause. There are lots of those around.
What about his family? Daggett's. They may feel they're entitled to the money, don't you think? I mean, I wouldn't want to take it if there were going to be any legal ramifications.
You'd have to talk to an attorney about that, I said. The check is made out to Tony, and Daggett hired me to deliver it to him. I don't think there's any question about his intention. There may be other legal issues I don't know about, but you're certainly welcome to talk to someone first.
Secretly, I wanted her to take the damn thing and be done with it.
She stared at the floor for a moment.
Tony said, last night he mentioned that he might want to go to the funeral. Do you think he should? I mean, does that seem like a good idea to you?
I don't know, Mrs. Westfall. That's way out of my line. Why don't you ask his therapist?
I tried, but he's out of town until tomorrow. I don't want Tony any more upset than he is.
He's going to feel what he feels. You can't control that. Maybe it's something he has to go through.
That's what Farron says, but I'm not sure.
What's the story on the migraines? How long has that been going on?
Since the accident. He had one last night, as a matter of fact.
It's not your fault, she added hastily. His head started bothering him about an hour after he got home. He threw up every 20 minutes or so from midnight until almost 4 a.m. We finally had to take him over to the emergency room at St. Terry's. They gave him a shot, and that put him out, but he woke up a little while ago, and he's talking now about going to the funeral. Did he mention it to you?
Not at all. I told him Daggett was dead, but he didn't react much at the time, except to say he was glad.
Is he well enough to go?
He will be, I think. The migraines are odd. One minute you think he's never going to pull out of it, and the next minute he's on his feet and starving to death. It happened last Friday night.
Friday? I said. The night of Daggett's death.
That episode wasn't quite as bad. When he came home from school, he knew he was on the verge of a headache. We tried to get some medication down him to head it off, but no luck. Anyway, he pulled out of it after a while, and I ended up fixing him 2 meatloaf sandwiches in the kitchen at 2 a.m. He was fine. Of course, he had another headache on Tuesday, and then the one last night. 2 the week before that. Theron thinks maybe his going to the funeral will have some symbolic significance. You know, finish it off for him and set him free.
That's always possible.
Would Barbara Daggett object?
I don't see why she would, I said. I suspect she feels as guilty as her father did, and she's offered to help.
I guess I'll see how he's doing when I get home, then, she said. She glanced at her watch. I'd better go.
Let me give you the check.
I pulled my handbag out of the bottom drawer and took out the check, which I passed across the desk to her. As her husband had done the night before, she smoothed out the fold, looking at it closely as if it might be some preposterous fake. She folded it up again and slipped it in her bag as she got to her feet. She hadn't touched her mug of coffee. I hadn't drunk mine either. I told her the time and place of the services and walked her to the door. After she left, I sat down at my desk again, reviewing everything she'd said. At some point, I wanted to take Tony Gayen aside and see if he could verify her presence at the house the night Daggett died. It was hard to picture her as a killer, but I'd been fooled before.
Chapter 17. John Daggett's funeral service took place in the sanctuary of some obscure outpost of the Christian church. The building itself was a one-story yellow stucco, devoid of ornament, located just off the freeway, the sort of chapel you glimpse through the bushes when you're going someplace else. I arrived late. I'd retrieved my VW from the auto glass shop at 1:45, after countless delays, and I confess I'd spent a few contented moments cranking my new car window up and down. The drizzle was beginning to turn serious, and I was heartened by the notion that it wouldn't blow straight in on me. When I reached the gravel parking lot beside the church, there were already 50 cars jammed into space for 35. Some vehicles had nosed out into the vacant lot next door, and some hugged the fence along the frontage road. I was forced to pass the place, snag a spot at the end of a long line of cars, and walk back. I could already hear electronic organ music thumping out in a style better suited to a skating rink than a house of God. I noticed from the sign out front that the minister was called a pastor instead of reverend, and I wondered if that was significant. Pastor Howard Bowen. The church name was composed of a long string of words and reminded me uneasily of the outfit that distributes pamphlets door to door. I hoped they weren't keen on converts. Mr. Sharonson from Winnington Blake was standing by himself on the low front steps, and he gave me a pained look as he passed me a mimeographed copy of the program with a hand-drawn lily on the front. His manner suggested that the services were spiritually second-rate, this being the Kmart of churches. I went in. An usher peeled a metal folding chair from a stack near the door and flipped it open for me. The congregation had risen to its feet to sing, so I stood in the back row, wedged in among other late arrivals. The woman on my left offered to share her hymnal, and I took my half, my gaze sliding over the page in haste. They were on verse 4 of a ditty that went on and on about blood and sin. I made some mouth noises, which I hoped were being lost in the general din. Aside from the fact I don't believe in this stuff, I don't sing too good, and I was worried I might be denounced on both counts. Way up at the front, I thought I spotted Barbara Daggett's blonde head, but I didn't see anyone else I knew. We sat down with a rustle of clothing and the scrape of metal chair legs. While Pastor Bowen, in a matte black suit, talked about what wretches we were, I stared at the brown vinyl tile floor and studied the staunch row of stained glass windows, which depicted forms of spiritual torment that made me squirm. Already I could feel a burgeoning urge to repent. I could see Daggett's casket up by the altar, looking somehow like one of those boxes magicians use when they cut folk in half. I checked my program. We'd whipped through the opening prayer and the invocation, and now that we'd dispensed with the first hymn, we were apparently settling in for an energetic discourse on the temptations of the flesh, which put me in mind of the numerous and varied occasions on which I'd succumbed. That was entertaining. Pastor Bowen was in his 60s, balding, a small man with a tight round face who looked like he would suffer from denture breath. He'd chosen as his subject matter a passage from Deuteronomy. The Lord shall smite thee in the knees and in the legs, with a sore botch that cannot be healed, from the sole of thy foot unto the top of thy head. And I heard more on that subject than I thought possible without falling asleep. I was curious what he could find to say about John Daggett, whose transgressions were many and whose repentances were few, but he managed to tie Daggett's passing into, "He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail," and sailed right into an all-encompassing prayer. When we stood for the final hymn, I felt someone's eyes on me, and I looked over to spot Marilyn Smith two rows down, in the company of a man I assumed to be her husband, Wayne. She was wearing red. I wondered if she would leap up and do a tap dance on the coffin lid. The congregation by now was really getting into the spirit of things, and hosannas were being called out on all sides, accompanied by amens, huzzas, and much rending and tearing of clothes. I wanted to excuse myself, but I didn't dare. This was beginning to feel like soul aerobics. The woman next to me began to sway, her eyes closed, while she hooted out an occasional, "Yes, Lord." I'm not given to this sort of orthodox public outburst, and I commenced to edge my way to the door. I could see now that the minister, doing what looked like deltoid releases, was leading his merry band of church elders in the equivalent of a canonical conga line, with Essie Daggett bringing up the rear. At the exit, I came face to face with Billy Polo and his sister Coral. He took me by the arm and pulled me aside as the service drew to a close behind me, and people began to crowd through the door. Essie Daggett was wailing, nearly borne aloft like a football coach after a big win. Barbara Daggett and Eugene Nickerson had arranged themselves on either side, giving her what protection they could. For some reason, the other mourners were reaching out to touch and pat and grasp at Essie, as if her grief lent her healing powers. The pallbearers came last, pulling the coffin along on a rolling cart instead of toting it. None of the six of them appeared to be under 65, and Winnington Blake may have worried that they'd collapse, or toppled their cargo right out into the aisle. As it was, the cart seemed to have one errant wheel, which caused it to meander, squeaking energetically. The coffin, as though with a will of its own, headed for the chairs first on one side and then the other. I could see the pallbearers struggle to maintain mournful expressions while correcting its course, dragging it up the aisle like a stubborn dog. I caught sight of Tony Gahan briefly, but he was gone again before I could speak to him. The hearse pulled up in front, and the coffin was angled down the low steps and into the rear. Behind it, the limousine pulled up, and Essie was helped into the back seat. She was wearing a black suit with a broad-brimmed black straw hat, swathed in veiling. She looked more like a beekeeper than anything else. Stung by the Holy Spirit, I thought. Barbara Daggett wore a charcoal gray suit and black pumps, her two-toned eyes looking almost electric in the pale oval of her face. The rain was falling steadily, and Mr. Sharonson was distributing big black umbrellas as people ducked off the porch and hurried to the parking lot. Cars were being started simultaneously in a rumble of exhaust fumes, gravel popping as we pulled out onto the frontage road and began the slow procession to the cemetery, maybe 2 miles away. Again, we parked in a long line, car doors slamming as we crossed the soggy grass. This was apparently a fairly new cemetery with few trees, a wide flat field planted to an odd crop. The headstones were square-cut and low, without any of the worn beauty of stone angels or granite lambs. The grounds were well-kept, but consisted primarily of asphalt roadways winding among sections of burial plots that had apparently been sold pre-need. I wondered if cemeteries like golf courses had to be designed by experts for maximum aesthetic effect. This one felt like a cut-rate country club, low membership fees for the upstart dead. The rich and respectable were buried someplace else, and John Daggett couldn't possibly qualify for inclusion among them. Winnington Blake had set up a canopy over the grave itself, and nearby a second larger one with folding chairs arranged under it. No one seemed to know who was supposed to go where, and there was a bit of milling around. Essie and Barbara Daggett were led into the big tent and placed in the front row, with Eugene Nickerson on one side and a fat woman on the other in a set of four folding chairs connected at the base. The back legs were already beginning to sink into the rain-softened soil, tilting the four of them backward at a slight angle. I had a brief image of them, trapped like that, staring at the tent top, legs dangling, unable to right themselves again. Why is it that grief always seems edged with absurdity? I eased over to one side, under shelter, but remained standing. Most of the mourners appeared to be elderly, and perhaps needed folding chairs more than I. It looked like the entire church membership had turned out in Essie Daggett's behalf. Pastor Bowen had declined a raincoat, and he stood now in the open air, rain collecting on his balding head, waiting patiently for everyone to get settled. At this range, I saw evidence of a hearing aid tucked into the tiny ear cave on his right. Idly, he fiddled with the device, keeping his expression benign so as not to call attention to himself. I wondered if the battery was shorting out from the damp. I could see him tap on the aid with his index finger, flinching then as though it had suddenly barked to life again. On the far side of the tent, I saw Marilyn and Wayne Smith, and behind them Tony Gahan, accompanied by his Aunt Ramona. He looked like the perfect prep school gentleman, in gray wool slacks, white shirt, navy blazer, rep tie. As though sensing that he was being watched, his eyes strayed to mine, his expression as empty as a robot's. If he was expunging raw hate or an old sorrow, there was no sign of it. Billy Polo and his sister stood outside the tent in the rain, sharing an umbrella. Coral looked miserable. She was apparently still caught up in the throes of a cold, clutching a fistful of Kleenex. She belonged in bed with a flannel rag on her chest, reeking of Vicks vapor rub. Billy seemed restless, scanning the crowd with care. I followed his gaze, wondering if he was looking for someone in particular.
"Dear friends," the minister said in a powdery voice, "we are gathered here on the sad occasion of John Daggett's death, to witness his return to the earth from which he was formed, to acknowledge his passing, to celebrate his entry into the presence of our Lord Jesus. John Daggett has left us. He is free now of the cares and worries of this life, free of sin, free of his burdens, free of blame."
From somewhere near the back, a woman hollered out, "Yes, Lord," and a second woman yelled out, "Bullshit," in just about the same tone. The minister, not hearing that well, apparently took both as spiritual punctuation marks, biblical whoopies to incite him to greater eloquence. He raised his voice, closing his eyes as he began quoting admonitions against sin, filth, defiled flesh, lasciviousness, and corruption.
"John Daggett was the biggest asshole who ever lived, so get it straight," came the jeering voice again.
Heads whipped around. Lavella had gotten to her feet near the back. The people turned to stare, their faces blank with amazement. She was drunk. She had the little bitty pink eyes that suggest some high-grade marijuana toked up in addition to the booze. Her left eye was still slightly puffy, but the bruising had lightened up to a mild yellow on that side, and she looked more like she was suffering from an allergy than a rap up the side of the head from the dead man. Her hair was the same blonde bush I remembered, her mouth a slash of dark red. She'd been weeping copiously, and her mascara was speckled under her lower lids like soot. Her skin was splotchy, her nose hot pink and running. For the occasion, she'd chosen a black sequined cocktail dress, low cut. Her breasts looked almost transparent and bulged out like condoms inflated as a joke. I couldn't tell if she was weeping out of rage or grief, and I didn't think this crowd was prepared to deal with either one. I was already headed toward the rear. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Billy Polo make a beeline toward her on the far side of the tent. The minister had figured out by now that she was not on his team, and he shot a baffled look at Mr. Sharonson, who motioned the ushers to take charge. We all reached her just about at the same time.